Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory number 72. Happy Friday. Deadline came and went and was one of the craziest ever. I don't know if it hit the craziest ever. I was looking at the moves this morning and there weren't, I don't think, as many as 2015, which is the only one that compares in at least my memory, but the scale and headlined by, I think, maybe the craziest trade in sports history, James Harden, Ben Simmons switching sides. It was action-packed. And when that news finally came across and affirmed what I felt like all along, that this was going to get done, made sense for both sides, don't linger beyond the deadline with that, is Simmons coming back to Philly and is Harden going to sign here over the summer thing. Neither of those clouds are over either of those teams' heads now. They both got things they needed here. Philly added value in Seth Curry and multiple first-round picks, as well as salary. Brooklyn ultimately wasn't able to flip any of that now. I'm sure that they're looking at this as a little bit more of a longer-term project now around Kyrie, Durant, and Simmons. So the landscape in the East definitely shifted. That potential that the big three in Brooklyn had quickly transfers right over to Philadelphia, who's going to be the preeminent East team. That still has to climb Milwaukee, I believe, and has some questions about Harden's shape and production for now. But in terms of a two-man tandem, they're going to be tough to stop. Now, Harden also has to overcome some playoff woes, but I don't think there was a guy out there right now to maximize this season more than Harden. So credit to Daryl Morey, who I have ripped on this and numerous other shows for taking the star-only approach that he did. It panned out. He knew something was out there and something would break, and his patience paid off here. And they're going to have a real chance to win a championship with Joel Embiid this year or next year. There's long-term concerns there. In fact, I think it's likely they're throwing the long-term out the window here, and they're going to run into some trouble at the end of this decade with that Harden deal. And Embiid's deal as well, which is now no longer incentive-laden. It's fully guaranteed for a guy who's injured quite often. But it's worth it. They haven't won since 1983. One championship would heal all woes, even though the Lakers right now are still causing agony for their fans and followers after winning a championship in 2020. So is this good for the league? The action's always going to captivate people. The tweets and the headlines, the Woj bombs, that's always been a big part of this sport and this spectacle. And this might have been the greatest ever when that tweet finally came across that this was getting done. But holdouts and disdain, weeks long in Brooklyn's case and almost a year long in Philadelphia's, are not great. That Simmons situation became agonizing. I know it was unique. I know he's a interesting figure in his own right who probably took a path that few others would do with this situation in Philadelphia. Worked out for him, too. I think he ends up in a phenomenal situation in Brooklyn. But is this going to become an every year thing? Guys going home, missing half the season. There's enough guys injured in this sport to begin with. And people, even though they're not the biggest stars in the game, they want to see Ben Simmons. They want to see John Wall. He's the main attraction in Houston. And other guys that have sat in recent years, we're seeing that Andre Iguodala's choice to sit out in Memphis might not have been that wise. Whatever role the teams play in this thing, obviously none in Philadelphia's case here. It's not great. I don't like it. I don't want to deal with another Simmons saga. And if this does become a year-to-year thing for a new guy each time, I don't like the legacy that this could set, working out for a player in this case. And even Harden, diving out after 16 games in Brooklyn, I think there's reasons that are legitimate. Irving's part-time status and callousness toward his role in the whole thing that they were doing there in Brooklyn, I think, had to be one of the headliners, as well as Durant's injury and Harden at this stage in his career not want to carry Kessler Edwards and whatever else they're courting out there. Joe Harris now injured, likely to miss the rest of the season. The pieces and the situation changed in Brooklyn, and of course, Harden, once he had an opportunity, changed his mind too about being there. So I don't fault that at all. And this deal is going to bring both these teams to a good place eventually. Brooklyn, still a scary force for years to come, with Simmons playing a point center role that can ramp up Brooklyn's pace and start to instill a defensive identity. I don't think anyone's taken a bigger sigh of relief here than Nash having this finally passed himself. And boy, did he have to lie quite a bit over the last 5 to 7 days here or so about where things were headed on the Harden front. Irving, he's the big question here. More important than before, he's got to raise his game and be a primary contributor on that roster, barring KD's health. And he's going to make himself available, and both sides are going to have to come to terms on a contract after this season, given what he did this year. I don't know if that max deal is just sitting there for him at the end. Now, they need him a lot more. He's the franchise. They've invested tons and tons of money in this. I don't think the Nets are going to let this reach a breaking point. So, who knows? Maybe they'll slap that max offer on the table again, especially if this mandate goes out of the way and they finish strong. So all can be forgiven there. In fact, I think the Nets end up winning this trade. Philly needs a championship to win this trade. Brooklyn, they're going to have quite a few cracks at it here. Longer into the future than the Nets are, I would imagine, even with Irving and Durant getting up there in age. This is probably their last destination. So there's that. I wrote about it at Boston Sports Journal last week. All the reasons I thought it would get done still stand. You can go check that out. We talk about it a little bit with today's guest, Matthew Tynan, who is mostly here to talk about the Spurs deal. Between the Celtics and Spurs, Derek White heading to Boston, picks and multiple players heading back to San Antonio. Probably the second biggest trade that we saw, aside from a four-teamer that was executed yesterday. And White going to become a swing player of sorts, heading to Boston and becoming something of a point guard for them there. Not a young player, not a guy with a ton of upside, but is his fit so good, and does he solve so many outstanding issues there on the Celtics that he helps them reach their potential? That's the kind of deal you're looking at there. In my mind, I wrote about it at clnsmedia.com. So go check that out. And we'll get right into this interview with Matthew Tynan. He covers the Spurs with his own Substack, matthewtynan.substack.com, former athletic writer, Texas Tech grad, and has covered the Spurs since 2012. Central Texas native. I'm excited to get into this with him. Good conversation here. Ton of insight on White's game and the risks and upside of this move for Boston, as well as where the Spurs are headed. I can't believe I'm doing two Spurs shows. We also had Noah Magara-George here for episode 66. I did more of the outstanding and DeJounte Murray angles with him. And this weekend, the big game, it is here. So we're going to give you a great chance to do props, everything else that comes with betting on the big game. And betonline.ag is where I'm going to do it again this year. Props didn't work out for me last year all that well, but I did bet the Buccaneers to beat the Chiefs and win last year's championship, and that worked out great for me. You can get in on the action this Super Sunday and take advantage of our offer. As always here on Dome Theory, CLNS Media, go to betonline.ag and go get the odds, scores, totals, player performance props, as well as when the next coach is going to be fired and where he's going to land. BetOnline is the number one spot for all things NFL betting in 2022. And it's not just football. There's still basketball, hockey, boxing, UFC odds. And their coverage is the best in the business. From sports, write down your favorite Vegas casino games. The width at betonline.ag is great. And I know they're not mentioning it here, but that website that they hit on for a while, it is great. So easy to navigate. BetOnline, as always, go use the promo code CLNS50. You'll get 50% welcome bonus. That's 50% back. If you want to bet 100 on this year's Super Bowl, you'll get 150. You want to bet 200? Well, let's do the math there. 300, and on and on and on. So go get that. Get started. Fun way to enjoy Super Sunday beyond the snacks and food and family and a great game in Bengals-Rams. Let me get into it because I do have some thoughts on this game. The Rams are loaded, absolutely loaded. Talent on the perimeter, big run game, vicious defense, and a four-point spread, I think, is warranted of going toward the Rams. This is not 6-7. In fact, it's moved down from 4.5. Even value for both sides. I'd go Rams. Now, the only thing that makes me not say that it's a lock is the Stafford-Burrow thing. Burrow has been outstanding. Their defense is competitive, too. This could end up being a low-scoring game, and if it comes down to the two quarterbacks making plays, I have more faith in Burrow, even as a second-year player, getting it done here than Matthew Stafford, who I don't want to call him a passenger, but man, has he benefited from some good talent around him early in his career, especially relative to being a number one pick who should be the guy transforming it himself. That's just how I feel about Stafford. He's had a good year. He put them up big in that Buccaneers game, but that Burrow-Stafford matchup to me still leans in the Bengals direction. Now, value wise, you get plus 172 on betonline.ag if you want to go the Bengals route straight up, which I don't think is a terrible decision. I mean, this is going to be a game. I don't think there's going to be a blowout. I do think the Rams have enough to separate themselves a little bit here, but there's a chance the Bengals pull this off. So, from a value standpoint, I don't think you can beat plus 172. 48.5, we're talking 24 each side. Let's go low scoring. I'm going to go low scoring there. And even if it's a blowout, hope that the Bengals score so little that the under still hits there. 48.5. I actually don't mind that number as an under. Super Bowls, they're not usually high scoring anyway. And as far as what else is out there, Super Bowl props, first half, first quarter, as always. Additional game props, performance-wise, those are all there on betonline.ag. You, of course, got your commercials, first scorer, even odd number on total points in a game for the Bengals and Rams, final score, first accepted penalty. All you can pretty much bet on anything in this game. Gatorade color, I did last year. You got halftime performances as well as Super Bowl MVP, which is always a fun one. Stafford, of course, best odds, 130, worst odds, rather, of anyone involved. Joe Burrow, better value. Again, if you want to lead the value with the Bengals side, can't go wrong with him. I do like the receivers, though, if you're going for a stretch. Cooper Kupp has, I think, been the MVP on LA this year, so it wouldn't be stunning to see him be the MVP in the game. I wouldn't go Aaron Donald. I bet defense last year, and the Bucs were about as close to having as a defensive MVP as you can, and they still didn't. Chase, probably not. Mixon, definitely not. I would go Odell Beckham if you're really looking for the stretch guy with plus 2,500. And, of course, beyond that, you were just doing a shot in the dark. So, head to betonline.ag. Of course, gamble responsibly. Enjoy the day. Get 50% back. Why not? And support CLNS Media and Dome Theory. As always, we appreciate betonline.ag and the way they support this company and our coverage of the Celtics and the NBA. Let's get into it. Matthew Tynan is here, and we're going to talk some Celtics and Spurs. Of course, subscribe to Dome Theory. It's on Apple, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you get your podcast. I'm Bobby Manning, and here is Dome Theory number 72. Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome in on a Friday afternoon after the trade deadline. Best time to regroup and look at what happened. I was looking at my phone last night, and once the Celtics trade hit here, I didn't even see what happened after that, and a lot of stuff did. It was probably one of the craziest deadlines ever. 2015's up there. I think this one passed it with the Harden stuff, and Celtics pretty busy as well, and Spurs, uncharacteristically active at this deadline. I'd say one of the most active 5 to 6 teams at this deadline. Matthew Tynan has covered them since 2012 with The Athletic and now on his Substack. Thrilled to have you, Matt. Nice to meet you. How about sharing a little bit of your background, covering the team with the people here? You know, you've covered the Spurs throughout the late end of this Greg Popovich era here, and now it looks like a little bit of a rebuild.
Sure, man. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I've been covering the team for about a decade, starting with Pounding the Rock with SB Nation, then on to the True Hoop Network with 48 Minutes of Hell, then sort of some more freelance basketball coverage along the way, and then jumped on with The Athletic, and then the pandemic hit and everything fell apart, and now I'm writing via Substack like so many others are these days, just falling in line.
Well, go subscribe to his Substack, you know. Great to get Spurs coverage. They're going to be an interesting team. MatthewTynan.substack.com. Thanks for being here once again. And this is interesting to me. This was probably the most interesting trade at the deadline. Derek White. I'm sure some people are vaguely familiar with him here in Boston and around the league, but he was a promising prospect for the Spurs before DeJounte Murray really hit his stride and became an all-star this year, it felt like. And now, maybe a little bit of redundancy between those guys. They certainly got a decent package pick-wise here for him. But this isn't something that the Spurs usually do, as I'm sure you're aware. Like, they don't really make these big shake-up moves here. And this is a guy that they liked, it felt like. You know, clearly grew and had some good seasons in San Antonio, and they signed him to a long-term extension in 2020. So what was the thinking, you believe, behind making this move here from their standpoint?
Sure. Well, you bring up the fact that the Spurs don't usually make moves like this, and it's true. I mean, it's literally been decades since they've had a multi-trade trade deadline. I think it's something like 1990 was the last time they made at least two moves on a deadline day. So it's been a long time. And really, what the Spurs have practiced for the entirety of Greg Popovich's tenure as coach is just, look, we're a small market. We don't depend on free agency for the big names. We realize the importance of continuity, of familiarity. We know that our system is really what's going to drive us to be successful. And of course, so does Tim Duncan, so does Manu Ginobili, so does Tony Parker. But what the Spurs had all those years, and one of the reasons why they just never were very active at the deadline, is because they just didn't want to screw up a good thing. They felt like as long as they had their pieces in place, that they could continue forward. If they didn't get it that year, they could sort of retool over the offseason. They don't get rid of their draft picks. They're very conservative in that sense, and it's understandable why. This Spurs team is a far cry from what those Spurs teams were. This is a team that is very much in the middle of a rebuild, or really just starting out, if all things considered. Yep. So while it might be shocking to a lot of Spurs fans right now that they trade someone like Derek White, who is a fan favorite, who the team loves, the players love, all of that good stuff, the culture stuff, it's really not that surprising when you consider where he is in the Spurs timeline. He's right sort of in the middle of his prime. His value is probably the highest it will be, given context and given his age, 27 years old. I mean, just think about it. That's not old, but he's 8.5 years older than Josh Primo, who they just drafted, which is kind of wild to think about, but that's where the Spurs are. They have a 21-year-old Devin Vassell, 19-year-old Josh Primo, even DeJounte Murray, who was drafted before Derek, the year before Derek White, is 2 years younger than him. So they're on a much younger timeline. They have guys that he's sort of blocking in the hierarchy. And Derek White, at this point in his career, he's a win-now kind of guy. And so I think that while there is a lot of value in San Antonio, or the Spurs valued him a lot, I think just in the general context and the framework of what they're trying to do, he's probably not the greatest fit and can be a super fit for a team that is looking to be contending in the near future.
Well, it's interesting. Deadline time, you hear all these rumors, you put stock into different things that could happen, you write about what you're hearing and what's being reported, but oftentimes that's past negotiations. And a lot of times the stuff that's ongoing right up until the deadline, you don't hear about it. And this wasn't something from either end that seemed in the cards. You heard maybe a little bit of talk of White being on the move, just considering where he is in the timeline, as you talked about there. But the Celtics under Brad Stevens are sending out signals, especially on Josh Richardson, that, oh, it's going to take a lot to move off him. But then a day before the deadline, the word got out that they probably weren't moving Richardson. And certainly there wasn't a talk of a big consolidation trade with multiple picks going out here. Point guard was an area of need for this team. I think White's an interesting solution if he is being viewed as that because of kind of his combo guard status there. But he is a good right. ball mover. I've always liked his game. I've always liked his activity. And the consensus seems to be that such an active offensive player and a guy who fits into their defense could mold and grow into a situation where there's more pressure on other guys. What kind of role was he playing in San Antonio, and how do you think he could fit in this dynamic in Boston?
I think the point that you brought up is sort of important. I saw Brad Stevens' quotes this morning talking about and giving a little bit more context. Like, this is not necessarily a win now type of thing. They like his long-term fit. He's under contract. I think what you're going to see with Derek is his role this season in San Antonio. He's essentially, for all intents and purposes, has been the number two guy in the offense. The Spurs share the ball a lot. They move the ball around. There's a lot of player movement in general. So there's not a, outside of DeJounte Murray, if you want to put it that way, there's not a super focal point offensively for this team. Even DeJounte's usage rate is pretty low if you're talking about number one options on teams in sort of the mid to upper 20s in terms of usage percentage. So Derek has sort of shifted into this number two role. And in all honesty, I don't think that that's where he's at his best. If in terms of his fit with the Celtics, it makes a lot of sense to me. He's naturally a second ball handler. I don't think you bring up the idea of him being a point guard. I think where he's best is when he's a secondary ball handler. When in action off of the ball, he gets into secondary pick and rolls or he flows through with dribble handoffs and gets into space, able to create for either himself or his teammates. I think that's where he fits best. And when you look at the Celtics with Jason Tatum, with Jaylen Brown, having him as sort of a number three guy, and maybe along the way, the Celtics go out and get another point guard to sort of drive the initial offense, and he's able to play off the ball even more than he probably will be in the immediate future. I think you're going to see that his fit is right where it needs to be, where he's like a third or fourth guy in the hierarchy. And I think that one of the main concerns looking at Derek White right now is the really serious dip in his three-point shooting. And he's never been a great three-point. Yeah, he's never been a great three-point shooter. But the first several years of his career, he's been pretty comfortably in the 35%, 36% range, which is fine. And I think it's kind of difficult to peg why he's had this dip this season. My just theory with it is whenever he was with DeMar DeRozan, LaMarcus Aldridge, whenever he had these more traditional focal points offensively around him, he was able to thrive in more space with less attention. He was sort of in his natural state. This year, he's had a lot more responsibility in terms of shot creation for both himself and others. And I think that's put him in a situation that he's not at his best. He's not in the best position to succeed in terms of his efficient nature of play, his really balanced attack. So I think that having two guys like Brown and Tatum is going to be great for Derek White. And maybe it's not this year specifically that like some big jump is going to happen because of the acquisition of White. But he's just a guy that can fit along whatever pieces you bring in. And I think that's probably going to be where his value starts to spike as the Celtics start to build out a little bit more around him and obviously Tatum and Brown.
Yeah, the one that shoots out in the role you talk about there is the 32% this year on catch and shoot threes. He's shooting fewer of them, as you mentioned, not playing off primary creators outside of Murray. And last year, obviously alongside DeRozan, the numbers were a little bit better in that regard, 37% mm-hmm. catch and shoot. More opportunities in that area. I also looked at the map. It seems like the corner threes are kind of dragging down his percentage above the break, better look for him. But he's certainly not a guy who's going to impact the shooting game for Boston. And it's interesting because they don't seem to care. They haven't put big investments into the shooters deeper down on their bench. No, it's crazy. You know, like we've seen this team shoot 9% in a game this year. They're not one of the worst percentage teams in the league, but they do shoot a decent amount. I believe they're 11th in attempts a game and like 34% from the field, which is in the bottom 10. So this isn't going to help that. It's probably going to make it worse. I don't see a lot of spot up 3-point shooting in his game, and you know, we'll see about with the catch and shoot, but this is a guy who I think they're going to have to work around to get more shots around the basket. And the Spurs are certainly a team that was pretty comfortable shooting the mid-range, and it feels like Ime Udoka is pretty comfortable with that as well. This is the other thing I find interesting about this, is Udoka coached him during his first two seasons there in San Antonio with Team USA. The Jason and Smart as well played with White and on Team USA in 2019, a run I really enjoyed. I liked that team a lot, even though they didn't win. So there's a connection there. And I find Ime's role in all of this interesting, because this is a guy defensively that fits his mold. Ball movement-wise is going to do the things he wants to see on offense. And I'm sure he had a pretty big say in this. So looking back on Ime's time there and with Team USA and everything, that had to be a big part of this, I would imagine, just due to their connection. I don't know what kind of idea you had of their familiarity with each other. I'm sure we'll hear about it in pregame tonight, but what was sort of their connection during his early seasons, and what was his early seasons like there with the Spurs?
Yeah, and you know, they only had a chance, they were only together for a couple of years. It wasn't a real extensive amount of time, but you know, when Ime was with San Antonio, Derek was really coming into his own. He came on pretty quickly. I mean, this was a guy who was kind of one of those late bloomers in college, you know, started at D3, eventually ended up at Colorado, was a short guard coming out of high school, grew into his body. So he was a late bloomer. He was mature by the time he got the league. He fit in really well with the way the Spurs wanted to operate, with the more free flowing attack. And it wasn't anything where he had to be in isolation situations. He could work out of pick and rolls, and he was just really efficient with all of it and slid right in, obviously, from a defensive perspective. He's been solid the entire time. So, I mean, you bring up the Udoka connection. Obviously, I don't know the type of conversations that Stevens and Udoka are having before making this deal, but Udoka is familiar with him. He knows the way he plays. He knows his best spots on the floor. He knows how he operates. I certainly think that's going to help White fit in or transition a little bit more smoothly than it otherwise might. But this is obviously a pairing that knows one another, that is familiar, you know, they're familiar with their styles, whether it's coaching style or the player style. They know what they're getting in one another. And I think going to help the transition. We'll see how the Celtics use him. Obviously, that remains to be seen. And as you mentioned, you'll learn more at shoot around whenever there's media availability. But, you know, for whatever it's worth, it's probably going to just make things a little bit easier. Their previous relationship and the fact that they understand one another.
Yeah, what's the best version of him look like? Because that's where I'm kind of stuck. What he's doing right now, of course, this year, you give up two first-round picks, essentially, depending on what happens in 2028. You give up Richardson, who's playing well for them. I'm not as concerned about that part of it, but the picks definitely put themselves out there a little bit, especially this season if they get an injury. I think with how thin the Celtics are now, what their fans have to consider, and you know, everybody around the Celtics, is that if they get banged up down the stretch here and slip in the standings, which are still ultra tight, that lottery protection gives you a little bit of leeway there, but there's a real chance the Spurs could steal like a top, you know, 14, 15, 16 pick there if things go wrong on the Boston end. So that's a risk that they're taking in the immediate and long term. If this whole thing falls apart, certainly the Spurs could be looking at a, you know, number one protected pick swap there years from now. So there was risk here. Brad talked about that this morning. He called that 2028 pick something you lose sleep over. I'm sure that was kind of the breaking point in all of this, getting it done. Mm-hmm. So good on San Antonio. Way back when, Boston asked for an extra pick in the Brooklyn deal. And that obviously ended up having a big impact on their future. Derek White, I like it as a consolidation move because I think he gives you a lot of the things you need as Boston right now. You talked about his fit and the way that he could play off Brown and Tatum well. I just wonder if there's any upside here. He's older. There's a chance he plays better in a better fit and with better guys around him, for sure. I'm not sure how much better he'll get individually. But there's always a slight chance of that. The question is where does this kind of go from here, I guess? Because there's got to be another piece that rounds this whole thing out offensively. They're not going to be a very good offensive team with what they have right now. But this deal, just looking at it at face value, what is the best version of what you think in your mind? Like, what does he look like on his best night?
Yeah, so on Derek White's best nights, look, he's an unspectacular player, if you want to put it that way. There's not one thing that he's just elite at that's always just going to pop off the page. But, man, he can – and I know this sounds cliche and everything, but it's the truth. He can do a little bit of everything. He's kind of like that perfect connective tissue guy. On his best nights, though, and I mean this in all sincerity, out of all the guys that have played Antonio over the last few years during his tenure in San Antonio, he maybe more than anyone else on the team was sort of the barometer for the Spurs' success. When he had good games, the Spurs jumped a notch, more than Murray, in my opinion. These are more than even Aldridge, DeRozan. Like, Derek White was a guy who, when he was in control of the game, could operate from any, whether it was secondary ball handler, primary ball handler, in the pick and rolls, out of, flowing through the offense and dribble handoffs. He was a guy that could control the pace of games. And when he was having a good night, everything was just stable because you know what you're going to get from your stars. You know what you're going to get for the highest paid players and the guys you count on to get you 25 a night or whatever it might be. Derek White is sort of that floor elevator. And whenever he's at his best, the ceiling spikes. Now, that's not going to be every night. He's a cerebral player. He is well-rounded in everything that he's able to do. He helps you defensively. He helps you as a ball handler. He has good nights, believe it or not. I know that the numbers this year really don't make it look good from a shooting perspective, but when he's on, he can be a very effective shooter. It's just been so up and down, and especially this season, I don't really know what's going on, like I said earlier, but the best version of Derek White is just a guy who is in control of the offense, who can control tempo and pace, who's going to take care of the basketball, who can score on his own, especially in space. He's not a great isolation guy, but if he's playing within the flow of the offense and especially off of primary scorers like Brown and Tatum, he is somebody that can get his own. He can set other players up. He's just, like I said, a high-end glue guy, basically. He can kind of do it all, and I think that along the way that Celtics fans are going to appreciate the cerebral nature of his game and the fact that he can just elevate the floor on any given night. And I know that that's not the sexiest thing in the world for when you're looking at giving up first round picks, when you're, never mind the Josh Richardson and Romeo Langford aspect of it, but giving up picks for this guy, he's going to be someone who can fit alongside anyone you put on the court. And it's going to be that way for the entirety of his contract, as long as he stays healthy. So I do think that there's upside, and I'm, like you said, Stevens acknowledged that it's a risk, and it certainly is. I think what the Celtics are banking on is that best version of Derek White, who's a third or fourth guy in the hierarchy, to sort of reemerge, to sort of get back to what he was when he had DeRozan and Aldridge next to him, and he wasn't one of the primary focal points. And if that's the case, if he does bounce back to sort of being that efficient player, he's gonna do a lot for the offense. It won't be spectacular, but you will see the results.
Yeah, the consistency is gonna be key, and the fit is as well. If there's a limit on his upside, that's gonna make this look a little more, maybe an overpay at best. And I've read a couple of takes this morning that people aren't thrilled about this. They could be a disaster if he just doesn't pan out into anything. Yeah, it's interesting. I liked it. My first thought when you see it, Richardson for White, it's like, wow, you sold high on Richardson, for a good guard here that does more things that you want. Then you see Langford thrown in. He hasn't worked, but if he pans out with the Spurs, that makes it hurt a little more. We talked about the 1-4 pick this year that could go the wrong way, and 2028 certainly is scary if things break in a really bad way over the next couple of years here. So I'm not as down on what you gave away here if you're Boston. Richardson's fine. He's having a resurgent season. You were ultimately looking at selling him for picks at best, I thought, and to trade him into something that's better for you now and into the future is a good move, I believe. I think Langford's time was just about up in Boston. And the picks, like, yeah, I think they've been like due it. To I think they've been due to cash in on some picks here. The question I have, I guess, is just, is there like a lower floor guy, higher ceiling type? Jalen Brunson is someone I think I've talked about a bunch and others have as well. Everybody loved DeJounte Murray in Boston as he started to rise, and his price, I would imagine, just went through the roof if he's attainable at all. Yeah. I talked to another Spurs writer early in the season. We tried to come up with a deal, and we just couldn't. We didn't even talk about Derek White on that day, which is interesting in itself. But the two questions I have left on him, I guess, are the passing leap this year that is interesting, his career high in assists on a team that's probably the worst that he's played on. That's probably something more of a opportunity thing, I would imagine, but at the same time probably says something about him too. And the defense is just exceptional. We haven't really even hit on that side of his game. The shot blocking at his position is in the top 10. I believe at his position, he's top 10 defensive field goal percentage as well. So this is a guy that really can make an impact on that end. But passing, you don't see him as a traditional point guard, which is interesting considering what they need there.
Well, I don't see him as a traditional point guard in the sense that, like, you're going to say Derek White is our starting point guard and we're good. He is more than capable of initiating offenses. But I think as far as his during his time in San Antonio, where he's been his best, because he's not this real high-paced, fast-paced, up-tempo initiator of an offense. A lot of times, especially in today's NBA, and especially with the way the Spurs play, which is get into early offense because you don't really want the defense to get set. You don't really have the one-on-one shot creators. You need the defense to just move by moving all your offense. So the Spurs, when they like to get into that stuff quickly, Derek White isn't great in that sense. It could certainly work with other teams who are more focused on running sets, getting their primary guys into the action, no matter if it's early or late. So I think that on a certain team, he might fit better in the traditional point guard sense. But to me, he's a lot better catching and working through secondary actions, like I said earlier, whether it's pick and roll, whether it's dribble handoffs. But to your point about the assists and his passing, his usage rate is up. This is the most responsibility he's ever had as a Spur. He's very solid out of the pick and roll, always has been, is good at setting guys up. He's not going to have these giant bloated assist numbers. He's never really been that type of guy, but it's just opportunity. He's had more responsibility this year. I know you mentioned the defense, so if you want to get, but I think that, I'm sorry, I keep rambling here. You can ask the next question, but in terms of his point guard and his fit as a ball handler, I do think that his natural fit is playing off the ball and being that secondary combo guard who can sort of flip back and forth, but you probably don't want to just pigeonhole him as your starting point guard for the long term, because he does look better going through as a secondary playmaker.
Yeah, so let's dig a little into that defense. Mm-hmm. Him and Smart have sort of been compared and contrasted in recent days, and Smart's obviously one of the best defenders in the league, guy that can guard just about every position, a lot of strength, box outs, good hands, steals leader in this league. I think there's a difference between these two, just from what I've seen in that area. White blocks a lot of shots, which is interesting. Smart doesn't really block shots that often. I wonder about White's switchability, which is obviously going to be a big deal in Boston's defensive system here. Is he a truly dominant guy on that end of the floor, or is he just a solid defender?
Yeah, I wouldn't call him a dominant guy, you know. He is very solid. You mentioned switchability. He's best against ones and twos, but if he gets switched on to bigger wings, he's fine. He can hold his own. You don't want him defending those guys, you know, for the duration of a game or anything. But no, if it's possessions here and there, he's going to be just fine matching up with bigger wings. I mean, we even saw it earlier this season in a Celtics Spurs game where he sort of locked up on Tatum toward the end of a game. And granted, that wasn't that was kind of an ugly possession. But Derek White is a guy who can switch and hold his own against whether it's a point guard, a off guard, a wing, a bigger wing. Like, he can hold his own regardless. I wouldn't call him, like I said, like a physically dominant defender, but he's very, very smart. He's also very good. You mentioned the shot blocking. He's got great timing, whether it's blocking shots coming over from the weak side, if he's recovering off of a pick and roll, coming back and pinning something against the glass. He's also, and this sounds funny, but I swear to God, you guys are gonna love it. It's a very niche thing in San Antonio, but that draws so many charges. I think he's got 20 charges already this season.
Him and Smart are probably gonna stand side by side and take one together.
It's comical, man. The number of times this guy takes clutch charges and turns a ball over is low key just a funny thing that people in San Antonio have been tracking for years now. But just in general, he does a little bit of everything. This isn't a guy that you're going to say, put him on it. Now, he's capable of this, but this isn't a guy you're going to put on another team's best player and be completely confident in his ability to just stifle him for the entirety of a game. But he's fully capable. And between he and Smart on the court together, their ability to switch, you know, they can defend similar positions. I'd venture to say that I'd rather have Smart on the bigger defenders. He's just a bigger, stronger guy. But in terms of Derek White's defensive chops, he's got versatility. He's super smart. He gets his hands in the mix with everything. And he's just always around the ball, super dependable on that side of it. And yeah, I think that all of these things, I know I keep bringing up the fact that he's well-rounded. He just does a little bit of everything at a really solid level. And again, I know it's not sexy, but he does play winning basketball. If his shot goes back to what it normally is, around 35%. It's not a super excellent number by any means, but it's solid, and he can win ball games when he's playing at his best. Like I said, he's kind of been for years now been the barometer of the Spurs' success on the court. Popovich even called him a couple of years ago, and this is with DeMar DeRozan and LaMarcus Aldridge on the team, called Derek White their second best player, their second most important player. So
only Pop would say something like that.
I know. It was pretty funny. And I don't know who he was making number one and who he was making number three. But he's been very highly valued in the Spurs system for years now. He's not a headline grabber. His big blow up games are sort of few and far between, but they do happen. Anyway, but from a defensive standpoint, just to come full circle, great switchability. He should fit very well with what the Celtics want to do. I know they gave a guy in Richardson who's a really solid defender himself. And Derek White's a little bit smaller than him, but I think he's going to have a little more of an impact from a number of different ways defensively. And then I do think he's more versatile offensively. I think that they upgraded not a ton in totality, but it is an upgrade. And I think he should be a guy that, like I said earlier, connective tissue on all sides of the ball, whether it's defense, half court offense, transition, both defense and offense. He does a little bit of everything pretty damn well.
Yeah, and I don't think he gave away a ton. The stuff that San Antonio does get back makes a ton of sense for them, though. That pick certainly is a nice lottery this year in case something goes haywire in Boston. Richardson, they sort of get the benefit of the value he built for himself. There was a ton of interest in him at the deadline as a sell piece.
Yeah.
And they'll obviously get the benefit of the extra year that Boston tacked on via extension. And he's probably going to continue to play well in San Antonio, depending on how much they use him there. But his shot's back. Right. He was in a nice role where he could just focus on scoring rather than playmaking. And I think people will still look at what he did in Boston, regardless of what he does in San Antonio here, if the Spurs want to try to flip him for another first this offseason, which I'm guessing is probably the plan there. Romeo's interesting. I never liked the pick. I didn't see the burst with him, and I think that's what limited him, and injuries above all are just constantly there with him. In fact, Ime sort of made a passing comment about Robert Williams this year that I think applied to Romeo too, in terms of playing through pain, missing a couple of games with neck soreness, another just bumps and bruises. That's always been a thing with him. He only played 92 games in 3 years here. So I think his time was just about up in Boston. Yeah. Didn't have great numbers this year. He had about 2 weeks where he played a lot and only averaged like 7 points a game. But this is the team you send a guy to, you get good coaching,
yeah, right,
and opportunity. And all of a sudden, Romeo's averaging 15 points a game over the next 2 weeks here. So there's a lot of guys that need minutes in San Antonio. Lonnie Walker,
yeah,
Vassell, DeJounte Murray, and all the rest there. So who knows? Romeo could be buried again here. But what do you think ultimately is the plan for him here? Is he just a throw-in in this deal, or is he a guy that they can really find value in, you think?
Well, he's the guy that I'm actually most intrigued by, I guess, from the standpoint of, you know, you mentioned Josh Richardson. Was he 28 years old, I believe? The Spurs have been loaded at the guard position, which is why, you know, it made sense to move Derek White at this point. I've already talked about kind of their logjam at the position with a bunch of young guys. So I don't really know what Josh Richardson's future looks like in San Antonio. My guess, just judging by the fact that they traded Derek White, similarly aged player, similar contract, White a little bit more expensive than Josh. But it doesn't seem on the surface like a guy who would be the long-term sort of answer, especially at, you know, it's $12 million bucks a year. It's not like it's a bad contract, but it's not one that the Spurs necessarily want on their books, considering their own timeline. So I don't really see Josh Richards. I don't really see him being the guy that they're going to move forward or look to like implement as a main cog in their system. But the Langford thing is really interesting. 22 years old, I believe, still. You said it, the Spurs development, their system, their development program has churned out a whole bunch of guys. I mean, starting, you were about with the guy that we're talking about today, Derek White, 29th pick, kind of came out of nowhere and developed very quickly into a super important part of what the Spurs were doing. You mentioned it's Keldon Johnson, DeJounte Murray, like these late 20s picks that turned into legitimate starters. So you're talking about a guy in Romeo Langford who was like the fifth highest recruit coming out of high school. He was a lottery pick. He was viewed as a guy who was kind of a man, this guy looks like he might have a ceiling, but if he plateaus and hits the floor, it could be really low. So he's the most intriguing guy to me. Some size to replace at the guard position. Derek White, I guess, I mean, you guys would know a little bit better, obviously better than I would in terms of what his minutes have looked like, but he seems kind of like the combo guard type again. And yeah, it'll be interesting. I think that it's going to be the young guys that the Spurs test out and gravitate toward at this point, more so than it's going to be someone like Josh Richardson, who they might try to flip if they don't buy him out straight up. You know, we will see, but only time will tell.
I think they could end up getting a pick for him this offseason. There's a lot of value to the shooting and defense he brings. Yeah, that I think contenders
for sure.
It's too bad if they did the trade a day before the deadline, maybe there would have been time to flip him again. But ultimately now he's going to have to stick around there, which isn't great for him or the team really. But that's just what it is. I hate sending high guys home. I hate that new trend. So you don't want to do that either. But
well, and I
he's
think
a good
that,
guy
like,
to have
you know,
around, I'd say.
He is for sure. And you know, from everything that I've seen with the Celtics, like he really had some good vibes with the players. I know the fans are high on Richardson, and I know that this is a guy who's really kind of made a little, I know he's bounced around a couple of times in the league, but he's made sort of, he's had these little followings at every point that he's, at every visitation that he's had. So it'll be interesting. I think that, you know, you talk about like maybe if they got it the day before the deadline, that there might have been a chance to flip him. And you might be right. I don't think the Spurs were necessarily like actively shopping Derek White. I think that this was more of a look. Basically, everyone on this roster is available at this point. You know, I just at right now, at the juncture the Spurs are at, you couldn't afford to say nobody is, or there isn't an untouchable player on this roster. And to me, it kind of made sense that at some point along the way, if they were going to move off of their higher value guys at the guard position, they were going to do it. So it will be interesting to see what they do with Josh. I do think maybe if the timeline was a little bit more advanced, maybe if they were a couple of years further into this thing, he would be a great fit for the Spurs, but I'm not sure it's the right time and the right place. So we'll
see. Too early. The Spurs had a good deadline. The other thing that's obviously floating around.
They had a really good deadline.
Yeah. So I went through all the trades last night and I was giving out grades. I think stunningly, the only two A's I gave out were the Kings getting Dante DiVincenzo for essentially nothing and Marvin Bagley, and the Spurs getting a first round pick with some protections, but does seem possible that it could convey the Raptors' first round pick for Goran Dragic, and you send out Thad Young. Thad Young just hasn't been talked about all year. He was essentially just sitting around there waiting for the next destination. Wasn't a lot of hype, it felt like, in terms of bringing him out there. And the Raptors were just that one team that has a million power forwards, wanted one more instead of addressing
the center position. They really needed one more 6'9 guy. That's it.
They couldn't help themselves. I know I'm a big Raptors guy, and I heard everything around them was that, yeah, they're looking at a center, but who knows? Nick Nurse might not want a center, and that looks like what happened here. And they end up giving up a first for Thad Young to get Dragic out of there, which, going back to the Lowry deal and what they got from that, kind of looks weird. That whole Dragic situation was a disaster with him just hanging out around the Heat the whole time. So bizarre, now he's on the Spurs. I'd imagine this heads right for a buyout, right?
Oh, immediately, yeah. It's funny, Goran Dragic, twice a Spur, but never a Spur. He was drafted by the Spurs. He was immediately traded to Phoenix, then comes back to San Antonio in a trade for Thad Young and will immediately be bought out. So, funny little situation. But just in general, the Spurs deadline low key. I know that when you talk about sort of the scraping around the margins, it's not always the most interesting stuff. But over the last couple of weeks now, really the last month or so, they've traded Bryn Forbes for a second round pick, and then they got in on the Utah deal. They've basically stacked up for Thaddeus Young. For Juancho Hernan Gomez.
That's right. They made two trades with the Celtics. I didn't even remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. This is their second one with the Celtics involved. So they basically just flipped these guys the greatest thing was they signed Bryn Forbes in the offseason for the mid-level exception, then move him on for picks halfway through the season. And then somehow turn Thaddeus Young, Drew Eubanks, and an early second round pick into what looks like is a first round pick that's going to convey immediately. All the Raptors have to do is make the postseason, which it kind of looks like they're going to, unless things fall apart. I know it's really crowded in the East, but man, they brought in picks. They did nothing to damage their cap flexibility. They'll have max room over the summer, potentially three top 20 picks in this year's draft, with flexibility to even convey in future years, and then going on down the line, extra second round picks, and the lovely pick swap that you've already outlined in 2028 with the Boston Celtics. So I think they've come away with this thing accomplishing pretty much everything that they wanted to. Maybe if there were more picks offered for someone like a Jakob Poeltl, they may have moved on that as well, but I think it was going to take more than what teams were offering for a guy like that, to pull him away from San Antonio. All in all, they've done really well this offseason, just all things considered.
It's great to be a facilitator, a seller. This is a great seller's market, I felt like, with just the play-in tournament and how crowded the middle of the league is as a whole. So they definitely bought into that with two teams in the Raptors and Celtics. We're doing better than they expected probably a month or two ago and decided to buy here. So they certainly were the beneficiaries of that. And if you're willing to eat some celery and stuff this time of year too, it can be good too, because everyone's trying to avoid the tax. And that's essentially what made the Celtics do all these backflips the last few days here, which is its own thing as well. So my main takeaways here. Yeah, they're not.
Oh, I was just
going
to say they've been market. Happy, and they've been happy to play facilitator here, seller facilitator. However we can poke our head in this and get assets for the future, we're here for it.
So I'm not terrified with what the Celtics gave away here. I think that scares a lot of people. Like you said, fans fell in love with Josh Richardson. I thought it was a good sell high opportunity where he came in a worse player than he went out, and you got good value for him. Romeo, essentially done with him there. And then the picks, you want to believe and act like you're going to be good, and those don't matter in my mind, especially when you have Brown and Tatum. So you make the playoffs this year, it's in the 20s. You're not too mad about giving that away. 2028, Brown and Tatum are still here. Maybe you don't even swap picks with the Spurs at that point. I mean, that's just so far in the future. We can't even imagine where either team's going to be at. So I get why that scares people. But if it was a deal breaker, I probably would have done it too. I guess my only concern is just that White's who he is, and it doesn't really move the needle all that much. And the next step's going to be key here. Do you move Smart for something in the offseason? I almost thought when the deal happened that they were going to trade Smart yesterday for a shooter or a wing scorer or something to that effect. The Bradley Beal thing's always hanging around there. Maybe Smart becomes salary, or White becomes salary and something like that. Who knows? And Tice comes in as a salary here too. So what's next is going to outline what this really means for the Celtics here. In the meantime, he's probably going to be a fun, effective player for the rest of this year, and they'll see how far that defense can carry them. As far as everything else to happen around the league, there was a bunch, but this is like election talk or whatever that you're just going to kick around with your friend here. What do you think of the Harden deal?
I'm just glad all that stuff is over. I think honestly, like, I think both sides did well. I mean, when you look at it in a vacuum, like, okay, in theory, the Sixers gave up a lot, whether, you know, Simmons, two first round picks, Curry, Drummond, who's been really effective for them playing behind Embiid this year. Like, they gave up, the Nets got a haul, but in practice, like, Ben Simmons hasn't been playing and more effectively. And he said he was going to do it, said he was going to hold out for a star. It worked for him. He got Harden. Forget all the contract stuff that's going to come later. Credit to him. He may not be the most popular dude, and he may be a little bit absurd at times, but he got what he wanted. So I think that for now, and the Sixers are very clearly doing this for right now. They have a guy in Embiid who's having an MVP caliber season, as good as he's ever been. So they're jumping in right now. They got what they wanted out of this. So good job on them. On the other things, it works out for the Nets. They get these extra picks. They get a guy like Simmons, who I think, you know, if everything is right with him, obviously, like, that's the big question at this point, right? We haven't seen the guy play in forever, so we'll see how he fits. But it makes a lot of sense to me. He plugs a lot of holes for them from a defensive perspective. The whole concept between Irving, Harden, and Durant, while we hardly saw them on the floor together throughout their career, they were obviously effective, but still the idea that these are three high usage guys, need the ball in their hands. It just makes sense to bring in a guy who can facilitate, who can sort of operate as a roll cut guy, play. He doesn't need the ball in his hands necessarily. It's obviously a lightning rod transition, offensive transition player. So I just think things worked out really well for both teams. It's kind of just this absurd overall situation, but I thought things worked out for both sides. And I just am praying that those two teams play in the postseason. That's all I can say. I want that so badly.
This is already a fun matchup with Embiid and Durant waving each other off the court and everything that was there. Simmons being able to play Embiid head to head. That would just be amazing. Yep. I guess the one thing that's still left to be written here is why Harden jumped out of that situation after 16 games. Like, was he really that mad about the vaccination thing? The cold weather thing's always goofy to me. It's Philadelphia, New York, and the taxes or whatever that was written about. I wonder what really was the issue that made him leap out of there after 16 games. Like, 16 games for those three together. It's just unfathomable. And this is why I think most people didn't believe this was actually going to happen, because the Nets didn't actually see out that trio. And they certainly were pretty – they had a ton of hubris all week about that nothing was going to happen here. But the fact that it made sense for both sides in the end – seemed to make them relent a little bit on what they could have fought for deep into the offseason here. They didn't feel like it was worth it, and they got good value for him. But why did Harden want to leave? Like, that's still what is kind of sticking with me, and I don't think either of us have an answer yet.
No, and I think that maybe there will be an answer at some point. You know, stuff like this, once the dust is settled, we start to get little tidbits here and there. And so maybe we'll learn more in the future. But, like, whatever it was, when I look at the Harden experience in Brooklyn, it just felt like it was one thing after another, whether it was injuries in the first year. And then coming into this year, it's the vaccine thing with Kyrie. And suddenly Harden comes to a situation where he knows that he has Irving and Durant, and then Irving's gone. And then he comes back and it's like one night on, depending on if it's an away game or a home game. And then on top of it, and I know we've seen stuff like, I think Zach Lowe even said it, like, it was likely that Harden wouldn't have been traded if Kyrie was vaccinated. And he's kind of made these little jabs at the situation.
I don't think he liked carrying the kids. Yeah. On those home game nights. I mean, I went to the game in Brooklyn last week, and they went down 28-2, and his hamstring was bothering him or whatever, and he was at shoot-around. He's just like, yeah, I need another game here. And it felt like whether he was getting traded or not, he was just going to take his time like that, because you're playing with Kessler Edwards and Blake Griffin on his last legs and all that stuff that's led them to 10 losses here. And I kind of understand him looking at it if this was the reason. Yeah, and was like, what am I carrying this for every night? Well, Irving won't get the damn shot, which we won't even get into, but I understand the frustration there. I do.
I think so. I think it's pretty easy. Like, when you look at it in that context, you can certainly see the frustration. And I think that if Kevin Durant hadn't gotten hurt just, you know, a couple of games after Kyrie's return, I don't think Harden would have been traded. I think it was just because if you think about what you're talking about, like, Harden's responsibility was just overloaded from night to night, and situations were so different from one night to the next. I think you're right. I think he just got exhausted by it. I think he just was tired of it, and it felt like it was sort of this way from the start of everything. Just wanted out. You can call it impatient if you want to, but like, I do kind of get it. I kind of get it. And I bet if Durant didn't get hurt, I bet he would have stuck around. He would have had a little bit more, not a little bit more help, a lot more help. At least it would have been Harden and Durant on a regular basis. And who knows what the answer to that is. But I think that everything just continued to pile up and pile up. He was just like, I'm done here, man. I'm done. Just get me out. I don't want to deal with this anymore.
He is Matthew Tynan. Thanks for your time today. Go get his Substack, Matthew Tynan, TYNAN.substack.com, corporate knowledge, covering the San Antonio Spurs. And they'll be an interesting team for years to come, the youth and the draft picks and everything else. That can always be, once you finally dive all the way in, a fun thing to be around and track. But good players coming in every year in these drafts now.
Yeah, it's certainly not something that you know, we're accustomed to seeing in San Antonio. It's been making the most out of late draft picks, and here we are the last few years of late lottery, and then this year it's probably going to be a lot higher up in the lottery if all things go according to plan, however you want to put it. But, it's interesting covering this team as a rebuilding team, certainly not something that we've ever had to do, or at least that I've ever had to do around here. So, yeah.
All right, Celtics Nuggets tonight. Spurs play tonight as well. go check out those games. And we will be back early next week on Dome Theory here. Go get us on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and all the rest. And, of course, Celtics All Access. If you're watching on CLNS Media, go check that out. We will be at the game tonight. I don't think White's playing. I haven't heard officially, but it doesn't seem there's enough time to turn that around. But if he is, finally get a first look at him in green. I'm Bobby Manning for Matthew Tynan. Thank you for watching.